Lee and I took the girls to hike down the path behind our house. Anna and Autumn showed Lottie how to make snow angels, and Lottie lay on her back with the girls on either side of her, flapping her arms and legs like a bird ready to take flight. It was the only time I'd seen my sister in the snow, and we were both surprised by the sheer pleasure it brought her. It was always like this. Lottie would creep into my thoughts on a daily basis, often where I least expected to find her. Sometimes the memories would be ordinary. A shirt in a shop window would remind me of something she would wear, or I'd hear a song she loved. I'd see her face everywhere, in the supermarket, at the post office, in the mirror, in Mia's smile. But more and more often, the reminders would be like today, a sweet moment I'd nearly forgotten, a glimpse at the half of me that was no longer here but still ached like a phantom limb. That afternoon in Golden Gate Park, I was certain that I knew her absence in the moment that it occurred. She was with me, and then she was not. Her leaving me was a whistle through my chest, a whoosh of air, and then a barrenness. As I crouched by the car that afternoon, I was suddenly aware of an echo in my heart, a sudden heartbeat that repeated after my own, an emptiness that hadn't been there only moments earlier, and I knew she was gone. Mark spent much of that afternoon trying to calm me down and convince me otherwise, but I already knew. When Sally called to say that the police were at the house about a car accident, I was only learning the details. The car drifting across Golden Gate Bridge, veering into oncoming traffic, and striking a bread delivery truck. Dead upon impact, the officer said, though miraculously no one else was seriously injured. She was driving to me and Mia. Of this I was certain. Though others might consider her death a suicide, I knew that she had tried to choose us. And though she was not successful, her attempt to clutch at those fragments of her life, to try to reach her hand out of the black instead of closing her eyes and sinking into it, that meant more to me than she could have realized. Her death was ruled an accident, and for this I was grateful. She hadn't jumped from the bridge, hadn't sat in a garage while the car filled with toxic fumes, hadn't taken a handful of pills or slit her wrists in the bathtub, or hung herself from a beam in the bedroom. The various ways that she could have chosen to die often flickered through my brain like the images of a gruesome film. I preferred to imagine her last moments filled with the scent of fresh bread, baguettes and sourdough loaves lining the road and tumbling into the Pacific. "Who wants to go for a walk?" I asked, turning away from the window, away from my memories. The girls looked up from their game, their heads bent together in concentration. Mia toddled back and forth between her sisters, snatching the game pieces from the board. In her thick, dark curls, I'd clipped a butterfly barrette of Lottie's, and Mia reached up every few minutes to finger it. Though she called me Mama, I tried to surround her with scraps and snippets of Lottie whenever possible. Before we could leave, there was the business of clothing. Snow pants and hats and big rubber boots were pulled on, mittens clipped to the sleeves of coats so that they wouldn't disappear. I'd always loved the solid roundness that snow pants gave to children, and I had the sudden urge to clasp each of my girls around the waist and feel their pillowy softness. Outside, flakes continued to fall, but it wasn't too cold. The snow gave the neighborhood a dampened silence, and the only sounds were twigs cracking and the occasional thump of snow sliding off a gutter and onto the ground. The trail led from the corner of the backyard through a small wooded area of public land. In the summer, it was often crowded with people, joggers and dog walkers, but today it was empty. The trees reached together, their thick skins of snow blocking out the natural light. surrounding us in white. There was something magical about the woods today that we all seemed to sense, and we walked without speaking, each of us taking in the blinding brightness with a certain reverence. There were times when Lottie's death was crippling. There were moments when I'd forget, when I would suddenly be reminded that she was gone forever, that I'd never again see her face or hear her voice. Sometimes the grief rocked through me like a spasm and I'd have to stop what I was doing to steady myself. Sometimes it was an effort just to breathe. Loving Mia helped. I could see the goodness of Lottie in her so clearly every day. I was patient in my care of her, calmer and more centered than I'd been when my own daughters were infants, intent on mothering Mia the way I knew Lottie had wanted to. The weeks after her death passed in a blur. The funeral, the packing up of her things, moving our father to Boston, the matter of Lottie's will in which she'd already named me Mia's guardian in case something should happen to her. I arrived back in Boston several weeks after I'd left, without a sister, but with my father and a baby that Mark and I would raise as our own. Miraculously, life went on. I still woke up each morning and brushed my teeth. There were still lunches to pack, dinners to make, and the nightly ritual of reading homework. My body still functioned, though at times it felt as if my heart did not. A few weeks after Mia and I arrived home, Mark asked me if I wanted to talk to someone. I was surprised by how grateful I was that he'd brought it up, and for the past 9 months I'd been seeing Dr. Litwack regularly, though it often struck me as ironic that I was the first in my family willing to accept this help. He was the one who asked me to read Caitlin's poems aloud to him, and when I was finished, wrung out and damp with tears, he said he'd throw them out for me. This past fall, I'd started to draw portraits professionally. When I began to decorate our spare bedroom for Mia, I'd hung the series of paintings that Lottie had in Mia's room. One morning, when Beth was over, she'd stood by the paintings for a long time, examining each tiny print. When I told her I'd made them, her eyebrows went up.
"Hell, Francie, these are great. Will you do one for Elijah?"
After I did the portrait of her son, she hung it up in her living room, where she had friends ask about it. I was surprised to soon have several commissioned jobs, and more surprised by how much I enjoyed painting again. I hadn't realized how much I'd missed the comforting scent of oils, the colored smears on my fingers, and the peace I felt during those quiet hours of concentration. I had business cards made up, and recently I'd even thought about renting a small storefront in Brookline. Through the white world, we walked. I carried Mia on my back, and Anna and Autumn wandered in front of us, turning around every few minutes to point something out to Mia. I was amazed at the ease with which they took in their new little sister. Never had they complained about my attention being divided. The grace and generosity they had immediately shown Mia had left me awed and made me love them all the more. We trudged along, clumsily and slow in our heavy winter gear, but we were in no rush. The woods grew thicker and whiter, as if we'd stumbled into the center of a snowflake with its intricate, carved-out corners. I felt a vast sense of gratitude rise up inside of me, mixed with the absence of Lottie. I wondered if the absence would ever leave, if I would ever feel whole without her.
"Mama,"
Mia called in my ear, her weight warm against my back.
"Look,"
Anna said, pointing up. A cardinal had come to rest on a branch. Its coat was a brilliant scarlet and stood out against the world of whiteness into which we'd entered. It was unlikely, I knew, but as I often did when something special happened,
I imagined it was a sign from Lottie. An absolution. A blessing. What other way was there to survive losing her? The four of us watched the bird, struck silent by its bright beauty. It bounced on the branch several times, pecking at the thick layer of snow with its beak. The bird hopped twice more on the branch, spilling snow in a light dust around us. And then it flapped its wings and took flight. We all watched, heads tilted back, a dazzling splash of color in the midst of all that white. The bird made its graceful flight up, through the thick silence of the trees, and into whatever lay beyond. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of This Bright Beauty by Emily Cavanaugh, performed by Christina Panfilio, engineered by Kevin Klempel. Performance copyright 2017 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc., all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225. Or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.